Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Take a moment to consider. Do you know what's actually in President Biden's proposed Build Back Better plan? Last October, a CBS News poll found that about 28% of Americans had a general sense, but not any specifics. And for the bill's supporters, the polling only got more troubling.
Nearly 30% of people say they don't know what's in it. And it is packed with social programs like free universal pre-K and paid family leave. Now, surprisingly, only 61% of Democrats think the plan will help them and their families.
Individually, those social programs have broad public support. The child tax credit, expanded Medicare, universal preschool, paid family leave. But put them all together and you have a bill that is stalled in Congress. Now President Biden says he'll likely have to break up the bill to get it passed.
I think there is, I'm not gonna negotiate against myself as to what should and shouldn't be in it, but I think we can break the package up, get as much as we can now, and come back and fight for the rest later.
Yet, as the Biden administration pushes on issues with broad public support, polls show most Americans are concerned about the direction of our country. So where is the disconnect coming from? Some believe the problem is the messaging.
Democrats have to do the one thing that seemed to bedevil them more than anything else, sell their accomplishments.
So today, we'll discuss Democrats' problem with messaging and what they can do to fix it. With us now is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, thanks for being here.
Hello, Kimberly.
So, Jack, when you hear the messaging from Democrats and from Republicans, when you hear how the parties are messaging, how does it hit you?
Well, with the Democrats, it's been well said that a Democratic bumper sticker would read, "To be continued on our next bumper sticker." They are the Democrats of communications. They are the Google Glass, the Betamax, the Ford Edsel, the new Coke of political messaging. This is an inveterate problem. It's been going on for years. And in November, Stuart Stevens, the former, I think he managed Mitt Romney's campaign, and he's now a dedicated anti-Trumper, he put in a paragraph the Democrats' problem. He said, Dow is over 36,000. Unemployment has dropped from 6 to 4%, over 5 million jobs added, 220 million vaccinations in 10 months, and yet only 30% of the country thinks we're on the right track. The Democrats have a huge messaging problem. They do. What they stand for is popular. They just don't tell the public about it.
So how should they be telling the public then about what's in this? I mean, you know, they hold press conferences, but people get their news from whatever news sources they themselves personally choose. How can the Democrats message better?
Well, you know, it doesn't strain the imagination to imagine ads, for example. You could show an ad of an elderly gentleman I can identify without any teeth and then with a perfect set of teeth. And then show a slide of Bill Gates and say, you can get new teeth and this guy will pay for it. Bill Gates. You know, that's one of the provisions in Build Back Better. It was free dental for we seniors. Sounds great. What's the matter with ads like that? They never do you see that from Democrats. And they avoid the class issue again and again. The whole beauty of Build Back Better was the rich were going to pay and the rest of us could enjoy it. Yet they just stay away from that completely.
And what role do you think Republicans are playing? I mean, they are better at messaging in terms of the effectiveness of that message landing. Do you think it's also them defining the Democrats?
Well, I think they do have a good bead on the Democrats, and they certainly have a good bead on messaging. Look at Trump. in 2016. What was his campaign slogan? Drain the swamp, a national appeal. Everybody can get to that. The Democrats, meanwhile, micro-target to all the groups in their coalition. And Ed Luce of the Financial Times has well said, you know, when everyone is a priority, nobody is. The Republicans speak nationally to citizens, to big things, and I would say big prejudices. The Democrats micro-target, and they miss the whole.
So I want to bring in now Mike Murphy. He is co-director at the USC Center for the Political Future. A longtime Republican political consultant, he also co-hosts the Hacks on Tap podcast with David Axelrod. Mike, thanks for joining us on Point.
Oh, great to be here, Kimberly.
So what do you share Jack's assessment that the Republicans are great at easy, simple messaging, and the Democrats are trying to invent new Coke every time?
Well, I think there's some truth to it for sure. Anytime an incumbent president's in trouble and the poll numbers start to drop, you know, kind of the interest groups around that president will start saying, oh, it's the messaging. They're not getting it through. And in this case, there is some truth to it. I think where I really, really agree with Jack is the Democrats do look at – Republicans and Democrats look at politics differently. They have kind of different catechisms in their communication strategy. If you go on any Democratic presidential website last couple of cycles, you will see some sort of reputation of a lot of groups. Mark Lilla at Columbia has written a great book about this. And, you know, they see it as a confederation of groups, many of them with grievances. The Republicans tend to go for one big, bright, shining thing, shining city on a hill, make America great again, one kind of unifying theme. And when the Democratic communications thing is all about our coalition and our voters and, frankly, treating primary voters like swing voters, it gets diffuse. I mean, nobody knows what Build Back Better is. Sounds like a chain of chiropractors. The better and more time-honored strategy, which I think President Biden is now retreating to, but I think it's a smart retreat, is break it up into bumper stickers people understand, try to win one or two of them, and fight over the rest in the election year, rather than look at this as a coalition politics thing where you've got to have a 300-page plan that each of your groups has 28 pages they love in, but nobody out in swing voter land, which is what counts in elections, can understand what you're talking about. So he's kind of been forced into better communication. I'd also say don't forget the overall narrative. You know, we get into this issue stuff. The press covers Washington like the automotive news covers Detroit. It's all about steering wheels and executive reshuffles. You know, out there in voter land, it's pretty simple. What are they doing, if anything, for me? And, you know, that gets lost in the dance of legislation, and then it frankly doesn't get through.
Well, let me ask this. You're talking about a message. A message needs an audience. And is it the fact that Democrats have a much different audience than Republicans do? Republicans, by and large, ideologically, are more unified than Democrats are. So can the type of approach to messaging be the same?
Yeah, I think it can and should be. I mean, I disagree a little bit with the premise. What the Republicans are good at, and of course, we learned this from the left in the 30s, is message discipline. The Democrats are not. I mean, from a Republican point of view, seeing President Biden whipsawed around by some progressive members in the House who basically said, no thanks, Grandpa, that breaks every Republican rule of march in a straight line. And, you know, I say that as a rebel anti-Trump Republican, but it's still true. So what happened in that larger narrative I referred to that made things tougher for Democratic messaging is the press will always cover the fight. When they're not covering the steering wheel, they will go to the car crash. And when you have 30 Democratic members of Congress saying, no, we're not going to vote for the president, our president's signature piece of legislation, you get a great car crash to cover. And Biden looks weak and marginalized, which is what no president ever wants. So negotiation and process became the message, not content, not the free dental work or whatever it might be. And that's the worst situation to be in messaging. And then finally, I think they made a strategic problem. Biden was elected to end the right-wing chaos and bring normalcy. And instead, somehow over there in the first 90 days, they thought, I've got a better idea. We're going to be FDR and we're going to swing huge. And that gives the Republicans an opportunity. You can't try to pass big legislative packages that you frankly don't have the votes. You might have partisan control, but particularly in the Senate, you don't have ideological control from the left. So you're kind of doomed from the beginning, and the narrative becomes failure, not success.
Jack, I just want to get your take on that last point, that Biden was elected for normalcy. He was also elected in the middle of a pandemic when there were fears about the economy, people's health, a reckoning on race. A lot of other things were going on, too. Do you think that he focused in the wrong place in the beginning?
Well, I think the Recovery Act, if that's what it was called, I think that was well-timed, and it seemed to have had a good short-term effect. On the other hand, it seemed to have given a fillip to inflation, which is now his problem, and along with COVID. And, you know, Nate Cohen in the Times today picks up on that idea that the Democrats are focusing on an ideological agenda when the public is worried about COVID and inflation. And maybe there's nothing he can do about either one of those, but it doesn't help to be focusing on this progressive agenda. And Cohn makes the point, FDR didn't do that. Yes, they had a lot of Social Security, and we're going to do labor relations and all that, but there was also just practical stuff, the CCC, the WPA, give the guy a shovel, give the guy a break. Where is that? Instead, we have this big ideological picture from the Democrats. And Mike has made the case, that, and I think rightly, that the progressives in Congress, who are all from safe districts, have held the rest of the party hostage. They're all going to be elected by 67%. Meanwhile, Abigail Spanberger down there in Virginia, she's going to, if she wins at all, it'll be by a squeaker. But they have set the agenda, the progressives, and set up, really, the party for failure.
Mike, what do you say to that?
No, look, I agree. I feel so bad for the so-called frontline Democrats that are in competitive districts getting lectured to and Biden being held up by people where an anvil with a D painted on it would win, or in some Republican districts, the same in reverse. So,
well, I'm going to pause you. I'm going to pause you both right there. We're discussing Democrats' problems with messaging and why, despite their push for popular agenda items, they're struggling to connect with voters. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're discussing Democrats' struggle with messaging and how they can get it right. We're joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty and also by Mike Murphy, co-director of the USC Center for the Political Future. I want to go to you, Mike, since I left off with you after the break. I want to take an example of an accomplishment of President Biden, and that's passing the infrastructure bill. Infrastructure is has long been code in Washington for something that everybody wants. And so that was a win. So how come that, in your opinion, hasn't carried a little more weight for him for in terms of his approval numbers? Do you think that's a messaging problem, too?
Well, it's certainly a messaging tragedy from, frankly, from my point of view as well as from the Democratic point of view. Biden and, you know, some Republicans in the Senate and Democrats managed to do something nobody's been able to do for, two decades. Big, bipartisan, meaningful legislation that's really good for the country. Yet we don't talk about that much, and therein is the messaging problem. The Washington funhouse mirror way of absorbing all this stuff, particularly the way the media covers process, you know, my old analogy about the car business, even though that was terrific, if you announce the car that gets 110 miles to the gallon, but the next day you announce your flying car and it crashes, all the attention is on the crash of the flying car. And it kind of smothers the amazing accomplishment. So it's part of, I think, their strategy of going so big so fast. Now I get it. If you're a Democrat, you're so tired of the madness of the Trump years. You say, my God, we finally got control of the House and the Senate. We have a president. Let's get all this stuff done, because if the midterm elections go badly, like they often do for new presidents, we're screwed. And so I get the appetites. But you know, in a world where Senator Manchin is from a state that 30% of only 30, a little less than that, voted for Joe Biden, you know, they didn't have ideological control to achieve that ambition. And then the process narrative of winning or losing in the Senate became weakness and loss, weakness and loss. So it was a tremendous accomplishment. I think he could have got a million miles of political support out of it, but it got yanked from the spotlight, the focus on other things, and that was, in my view, the single biggest strategic mistake. They should have passed it first and rode the wave of support, but then again, enter House progressives and said, no, we're going to throw a huge monkey wrench in this thing and deny you a big deal. I'll just parenthetically say it took the Democrats losing a governor's race in Virginia that they were favored to win with former Governor Terry McAuliffe to kind of shock the House into stopping the fratricide and giving Biden that bill, the last inch of it, to get it done. I wish they'd had that kind of, from their point of view anyway, I bet they wish they had that kind of practical thinking 5 months before the Virginia election. A lot of things could have been different.
Jack, a listener on Twitter writes, the problem with Democrats' messaging has more to do with strategy than words. As illustrated, Democrats prefer low engagement conditioning strategies, and Republicans prefer high engagement confrontational strategies. Do you think our listener's onto something, Jack?
I think there's something to it. I've heard people make the distinction this way. The Republicans are into strategy, the Democrats tactics. You know, small stuff. Feint here, nudge there, appeal to this group, appeal to that group. It's Wednesday, we're talking about, you know, suburbanites. On Thursday, we're talking about inner city people, farmers. Whereas the Republicans are into the big strategy, drain the swamp, make America great again. So it is tactical communicating rather than big talking to the nation. And of course, the Democrats used to be good at that. You know, they had, think of the great phrases, rendezvous with destiny. The big picture that they used to give in their rhetoric. Has a Democratic president said anything? Well, has Biden said anything memorable in the time he's been there? I'm not aware of it, other than, look, it's not hyperbole. I'm telling you the truth.
Well, let's consider the media, which I know Democrats say, at least they tell me, is part of the problem of their messaging. Here's Fox News in April of 2018, and that was the lead up to the midterm election, highlighting the migrant caravan, an issue that then President Trump focused on.
It is true, though, that the president's tough talk has had an overall, not just tough talk, but tough stance on immigration, on illegal immigration, has had an overall effect on illegal immigrant crossings since he has taken office. I think from March 2016 to March 2017, the drop of illegal immigrant crossings was 60%. And many people call that the Trump effect.
Fox News continued to give much attention to the migrant caravan in the following months. What role does the media play, Mike, in this political messaging?
Well, the media does set the agenda. In the White House, what you're trying to do is set your own agenda and make the media and everybody else respond to it. So it's kind of the jump ball of all this. The thing about Fox versus MSNBC, and disclaimer, I'm a MSNBC, NBC News analyst, it is – we tend to focus on that, but it's much wider. There's a much wider spectrum of places where people get information now. And the challenge you have is your primary electorates, your hardcore activists on both sides have an outsized voice. The congressional staff zero in, some of the members, their 100 friends who helped them on the first campaign, they call them up on their cell phone and complain. So even though they don't reach all of America, they reach political America on both sides. Each side kind of has their radio-free liberal or radio-free conservative. And they have an outsized influence. Sorry, early out here, and they tend to amplify conflicts and reinforce tribal warfare. You know, we have this terrible new equation in American politics that I think former Democratic Congressman Bill Gray coined, which was the new equation is I'm right, you're evil. And
are you there, Mike? I think we've lost Mike's line. Jack, what do you think? Do you think the media is the main driver of the messaging problem with Democrats, or is it the Democrats themselves?
Well, the Democrats have a media problem. They are responsive to media that actually reports the news, and the news is bad. Afghanistan was a debacle. Inflation is a real problem. COVID, Omicron is rampant. That's the news. It's reported, and the Democrats have to respond to the New York Times, to MSNBC, which does report the news. Fox News does not. You know, I mean, those evening news people, they're not talking about the news. They're just ginning up resentment and ideological, kumbaya. So there are two medias. There's the real media. Democrats have to respond to it, where real world problems are discussed, and they're big. And then there's the cocoon, where it's all just let's talk about critical race theory or whatever the caravans or whatever the issue of the day is. And there are two different media environments. The Democrats have to play by the real one. The Republicans have their echo chamber.
And Mike, we lost you. I just wanted to give you a chance to finish your point.
Oh, well, I've got a whole new point, which is the solution to all President Biden's messaging problem is free, better internet service here in Los Angeles. So there we go. That would be a message. But my point is because the inside process game runs on conflict. The loudest beacons aren't helpful when you're trying to move a big message. They're all about today's incredible atrocity by the other side or issues they create, and Fox does this in particular, which don't help. It's just in the old days, president said something, three networks cover it, and 85% of America hears it. You know, we're not in that world anymore.
Yeah. Well, what about the messenger? A big difference between President Biden and his predecessor, former President Trump, is that former President Trump spoke in short, easy to understand terms and repeated himself often, build a wall, make Mexico pay for it. Is it the messenger, both in the style and also in the way that the Americans receive that message, Mike?
Well, I'm not of the Trump emulation theory in any way. I mean, if you back up, Trump was, as I'll quote Biden, here's a good Biden message, at least for Democrats, Trump was a defeated president. The party got wiped out while Trump was president. Trump was a trail of tears for Republican electorals. He won one thing the first time he got elected. After that, it was a disaster. His unfavorable rating went to the moon. He's still the most unpopular thing in American politics. So I get the point about Trump used social media well. He sloganeered. But I think, in fact, he was a weak messenger. Biden is a mixed bag. On one hand, he has a natural sense of empathy. That's him at his best, and I think people believe it. He can connect to working-class white voters better than some of the more pejorative term, but some of the more disconnected voters with. You look at my relatives in Detroit, look at Biden, they say, hey, that guy, he likes Corvettes and can change a tire. You don't hear that sometimes about leaders in the Democratic Party. The minus of Biden is process. And sometimes his tone is off. I mean, I'm sure somebody on his staff before the press conference said, now remember, we're on a 35% country going in the wrong, right direction number. Most people think things are in the wrong direction. Don't cheerlead. Accept the premise they believe that we're in trouble together and we have things to do to get out of it. And instead, he went out and did the parade of statistics about how wonderful everything is, which is a disconnect. So I would call him an uneven messenger. I don't think he's a core problem, though. I think the message he's out trying to convey is unaligned, and I think strategically and tactically they've really been missing the boat. But, you know, we saw the beginning of a reset. It was awkward, but it was a reset. And if he pulls that off right, he's going to do himself some good. Gets it back to kitchen table issues people understand and stays on offense about the Republicans.
Another listener on Twitter writes, Democrats have it tough. They have a much broader base to appease. Either way, it's frustrating. They keep letting arguments boil down to how much money they want to spend. It's too easy for Republicans to label everything as too expensive. Jack, sort of relatedly, is part of President Biden's messaging problem out of his control? I mean, you also have a lot of other factors. You have an inability to get consensus among Democrats in the Senate on his big legislative agenda items. You have Republicans who are solidly in opposition to everything he wants to do. Is this all Joe Biden's fault?
No, by no means. And the inflation isn't his fault. And I think you can fault him on being behind on Omicron, but I don't know what, in all candor, what they could have done. He's not the world's greatest communicator, but the problems are real. And I think that what Mike's talking about, this moment might be the moment when the president stops focusing on what the progressives in the House want. They are on another planet from the rest of the party. Focus on the swing people. Give them something to talk about. You know, Bill Clinton used to get such mileage out of school uniforms. Remember that? Why did that register? I don't know. It just resonated with Americans. It was small. It was doable, and they could see it. And I think Biden may be getting the message that he's been listening to the wrong people. However, I think he's got to do something about some of his staff. I was just noticing that Ron Klain, who's a very, you know, able political operative, he referred to inflation in November, because it was November, it wasn't so bad, but he called it a high-class problem. A high-class problem. I mean, that's the kind of thing that gets Democrats in trouble.
And Mike, what do you think about that, the trying to go ahead.
No, Kimberly, thank you. In the question wording, I think lies the problem for much of American politics, and particularly right now the Democrats. The premise of the listener said he's got so many groups to appease. This is what's changed over 20 years. It used to be you could count on your base voters to always vote your party 90% of the time. That's why you called them the base voter. And you had to go contort a little to go convince the fickle swing voters or even steal a few voters on an issue from the other side. Gave you a little strategic mobility. I came up doing Republican governors in purple to blue states, Massachusetts, Michigan, Wisconsin, California, et cetera. And that's always how we did it. Then first in my party and now in the Democratic Party, this rule came up that base voters are the new swing voters. You've got to appease them. No, you actually mistreat your base a little, like Clinton did, triangulating to go get from 45 to 51 and win more political power. So the phantom idea that terrifies everybody in politics now is the base will be mad. Well, that will cause you trouble in a primary if you're an elected official, say a member of Congress. But this idea that the base are all going to stay home and not vote for you, when that's what the base does, and history proves that you almost never see total base collapse ever, that's the broken compass right now. So the last thing the Democrats need to do, and I think Jack kind of got at this in a smart way, is appease their base all the time. They need to triangulate and show the softer voters victories, Biden in charge. Issues they understand. Yeah, child care tax credit. I got it. Even some Republicans voted for it. The infrastructure bill. That is how Biden could hold on to the Senate in this looking tough midterm rather than get wiped out in both houses trying to appease people in the base of his party who are going to be on the Democratic side anyway. Remember, when you count votes, it's arithmetic. It's not complicated. An angry or I would even not even say angry, a irritated Democratic voter counts as much as an ecstatic one. And if you irritate your base voters a little to get a lot more voters, that's better than having a lot of ecstatic voters as you go down in flames by 10 points.
Mike, but that just a follow-up, that presumes yeah. that the audience has remained the same. Has it? Are there as many swing voters that are out there, or is that more chasing a unicorn for the Democratic Party?
Oh, no, they're still there. The progressives have been very good in their own fight arguing swing voters don't exist anymore, appease us, we are the Democratic Party. And it's worked in the inside game. It hasn't worked in the election game. Look at some of the primaries this year where the progressives, the Ohio special, for example, got wiped out. The New York mayor's race where the two moderates did the best in the most liberal Democratic electorate of any big city in the country. There are fewer swing voters, but they still exist. You can look at the delta between how, where and how Trump won and lost versus Biden as opposed to Hillary Clinton. They totally exist, but the Democrats don't talk to them. So watch what happens in this midterm where even subpar right. Republican candidates could win.
All right. Mike Murphy is co-director at the USC Center for the Political Future. Mike, great having you.
Great to be here, Kimberly.
And we're discussing Democrats' struggle with messaging and how they can get it right. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store. On Monday, we'll be talking about hospitals and the American health system. Hospitals are overwhelmed during the Omicron wave we're going through right now. And experts say the problem is not just the pandemic, but long-standing problems with the way this country's health system works. So we'll look for solutions. If you or someone you know has recently been in the hospital, in the ER, the ICU, or any hospital bed, tell us your story at 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about why Democrats have struggled to communicate effectively with voters, despite their popular agenda, and what they can do to get it right. I'm joined by Jack Beatty. He's On Point's news analyst. And we spent a lot of time discussing Democrats' struggle with effective messaging, but there have been exceptions too. Take Obamacare, for instance. Most Americans had supported what was in the Affordable Care Act, but balked when it was dubbed Obamacare.
Obamacare is so flat out unpopular that even the Obama administration chose to reject part of Obamacare last Friday when they tried to throw out the CLASS Act, which is the long-term care function.
That's former Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann in 2011. She wasn't the only Republican who pressed on this idea that Obamacare was unpopular and worth repealing. In response, Democrats rallied around the defense of the Affordable Care Act.
But I hope you haven't been discouraged by how hard it's been, because stuff that's worth it's always hard. Civil rights movement was hard. Getting women the right to vote, that was hard. Making sure that workers had the right to organize, that was hard. It's never been easy for us to change how we do business in this country.
That effort helped Democrats get past the messaging issue. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, the public's view on the ACA is at an all-time high today, with about 58% of Americans finding it favorable. So Democrats have been able to turn around on an issue with successful messaging before. So what might effective messaging look like for them now? Joining us now is Anat Shenker Osorio. She's a communications researcher and principal of the consulting firm ASO Communications. She also hosts the Words to Win By podcast. Anat, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Kimberly.
So how can Democrats get to where they are now with Build Back Better, which seems very similar to the Affordable Care Act in that the whole idea either is unpopular or people don't understand it, but the parts of it are very popular?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So there are certain principles of effective and persuasive and galvanizing messaging that we see over and over. The first is say what you're for, say what you're for, say what you're for. All too often, and I like to joke that if the Democrats had written the story of David, it would be a biography of Goliath, because we like to talk about our opposition a whole lot. We also frequently begin our messages with, boy, have I got a problem for you, which is not that popular, not that effective. So first, you want to say what you're for. Second, you want to seize the moral high ground and make it clear, as Mike was remarking in the earlier segment, the media feeds on conflict, and you have to understand that it's not just a question of crafting the message, it's a question of making sure the message gets through. A message is like a baton that has to be passed from person to person to person. If it gets dropped anywhere along the way, it is by definition not persuasive. If nobody hears it, it's not persuading anyone. So what would that sound like in terms of Build Back Better? Well, again, to echo what was said in some of the earlier segment, it would be about selling the brownie and not the recipe, not talking about the policy. So not saying, for example, paid family leave, even though that's wildly popular, but instead saying you're there the first time your newborn smiles. Not saying, for example, raising wages, although that's also wildly popular, but saying instead you make enough to put food on the table in your home in time to eat it. Speaking in imageable terms.
Jack, what do you think about that?
Oh, boy, devoutly to be wished. I mean, that just sounds wonderful. And, you know, it's been done. In the 1940 campaign, when the defense buildup had started, FDR would go around the country, be in Seattle, and he'd be talking to an audience, and he'd point and say, "See across the Puget Sound there, that factory making arms? How many of you work there? How many people in that factory spend money in your community?" He would do that all over the country at WPA sites, at defense sites. This is set up for Biden and the Democrats. Go to a crumbling bridge. Go to an area that can't get broadband and say, "Hey, folks, you're gonna get it, and it's coming. We've already passed the bill." It's set up for that kind of retail appealing politics.
Anat, earlier I talked about Republicans' use of simple messaging and repetition. You have pointed to another thing that Republicans do, the illusory truth effect. Explain to us what that means.
Yeah, so the illusory truth effect is one of many cognitive biases, and basically it's the phenomenon wherein a thing that feels familiar to our brains feels more true. So when we do experimentation message testing, a message that people have heard before, repeated over and over and over, is rated to be not just more true, seems more true, seems more credible to them, but they actually like it better. And the reason for that is because it creates what we call cognitive ease. It's essentially that I say to you, da, 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 and your brain goes, da, da, Well, maybe yours doesn't, Kimberly, but I was thinking you'd give me
Yes, I got it. Sorry.
And so, no, it's fine. And so it saves us work, right? It lets us stay in our automatic processing brain, our system one brain, as Daniel Kahneman described it, as opposed to having to engage in sort of more caloric, more taxing thought. And so what Republicans do is, as was said before, and, you know, this is not a new thing to recognize, they say the same thing over and over and over again. And progressives and Democrats, in our zeal to be upset about the fact that they are just spewing, in many cases, unrepentant lies, we will say there is no fraud. There was no fraud found. There was no evidence of fraud. We will think we're getting clever by calling something, quote unquote, a fraudit. And really what we see again when we do experiments is that when we negate, people recall the assertion, but they can't remember whether it was true or false. Because again, what Republicans understand is that if your words don't spread, they don't work. And actually, people don't vote. And this is going to blow up a lot of this, the assumptions that are baked into elements of this conversation. People actually don't vote on policy. They vote on identity. They vote on a feeling that they are connected to some sort of broader community and social proof. This is what my kind of a person does. And so when you have something like the red hat, and everyone is wearing the red hat, and a person who barely follows politics but does vote, or votes at least occasionally, flies into the Central Valley of California, or flies into Western Pennsylvania, or flies into the middle of Ohio, wherever, and they see a sea of red hats, and they're thinking, what does a my kind of person think? There is nothing that we can say, and yeah, I'm a messaging lady, there is nothing that we can say that is as loud as what people do.
I want to, on a similar note, I want to read a comment from Twitter from one of our listeners. It says, Democrats should finally bluntly and vigorously call out the lies, misinformation, misconduct, and anti-democratic activities of Trump and the GOP. No more euphemisms, no more decorum. Call them liars, come back with facts, expose truth, and control the narrative. Jack, if people are voting based on identity as opposed to just the message, as Anat says, is that the right approach, do you think?
Well, you know, that'll, to get back to Mike Murphy, that'll work for your base voter. I mean, that's what they want to hear. But if you target your message there, you're missing people who are susceptible to, you know, much less fraught and frothy appeals. Who you could say, you know, the pound of hamburger, you paid X last week, it's so much less this week, we're working on inflation. So it depends, you know, who you're talking to. And I think Mike really identified something there. The Democrats should pocket their base voters. And he made the point. He said, you know, an ecstatic base voter counts just as much as a disgruntled voter, but they'll vote. Democrats seem to have lost that.
And Anat, you say that there's a I don't want to say a formula, but there's a way to be more effective with messaging, the three V's. Explain to us what that is.
Yeah, for sure. So what we found is that the exact same three sentences, but tried out in a different order, actually have a remarkably different effect, both in terms of persuasion and in terms of level of engagement from the base. And the order that does work, as opposed to starting your message off with, boy, have I got a problem for you, can be easily shorthanded as values, villain, vision. So what does that sound like? Let me take an example. I'm going to talk about raising wages. So you start with a higher order value. No matter what we look like or where we come from, most of us believe that people who work for a living ought to earn a living. That's your value statement. Second, what's getting in the way of that value? But today, a handful of billionaires and the politicians that they pay off are holding down our wages and denying us benefits, no matter what their profits. And then they divide us from each other based on what we look like, where we live, or what we do for a living, hoping we'll look the other way while they collect kickbacks and make themselves rich off the wealth our work creates. By joining together and electing real leaders who represent every single one of us, we can make this a place where we can care for our kids, put food on our tables, and be home in time to eat it. That's that third sentence, the closing vision.
And do you see any examples among Democrats of people doing that correctly?
Yeah, for sure. And here, I want to challenge some of the assumptions that have been raised in parts of this conversation that there is some sort of division between turnout and persuasion. And are you doing turnout, i.e., are you inflecting toward your base, or are you doing persuasion, are you inflecting toward the swing? Turnout is persuasion. If the base won't carry the message, it's not going to get to the middle. This is something that the right wing understands incredibly well. They know that the job of a good message is not to say what's popular, it's to make popular what they need said. Look what they did after their autopsy, after they lost the second time to Obama. They had that autopsy and they said, we should do popular things, we should moderate, we should not go full force, whole hog into our peddling of hate and fear. And you know what? They did the exact opposite. Because they know that by keeping their base engaged and enraged, that is what creates social proof and that is what persuades the middle. Because people are busy and they are looking around for what is repeated over and over. So who actually gets this strategy of speaking to higher order values, as the last commenter just said, yeah, calling out what is getting in our way, who are the villains, what is keeping us from having what we need, and then closing with value. I would point to folks like Stacey Abrams is doing it beautifully. She always has. I would point to folks like Charles Booker. I would point to, honestly, the campaigns that I know most closely, which are the state races that we won in, I mean, it was a national race, but the way that we fought it at the state level in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. You look at the places where we actually flipped, those three, Arizona, Georgia. What did organizers say to Georgia voters in the recall? They said, our work is not done yet. They said, Mitch better have my money. They imbued voters with agency, which is the other part of the story. We need to make voters the protagonists of our story, not Democrats, not our party. It's voters, because voters are the ones that we need engaging. And so we want to make it clear that they're the ones that have delivered in the past and that will again.
Jack, in just these final moments that we have left, what do you think President Biden should do now? What should be the top messaging strategy as he comes out of his first year in office?
Well, I think he's got a choice here between what we've just heard, which seems to me it goes against what I was saying, but it gives me pause. Do you go to fire up your base and then hope that will send a spark into the middle? Or do you just go for very practical things, a la Bill Clinton, school uniforms, you know, midnight basketball, whatever it might be? I think he's got to make a choice there. My guess is he's made the choice to go toward the, quote, middle and to try to pocket the base. And maybe that'll hurt them in the fall. You know, you can certainly think that it hurt Hillary Clinton. Where did she lose Michigan? In Detroit. Where did she lose Wisconsin? In Milwaukee. She didn't get the base out. And I think that's that goes to strongly make that point.
But can he do both? Does he need to do both?
Well, I think he can. I don't know. But he can certainly count on fear of Trump and Republican authoritarianism. If any base voter doesn't understand that, they're lost to the Democrats anyway.
Jack Beatty is On Point's news analyst. Jack, always good to talk to you.
Thank you.
And Anat Shankar Osorio is founder and principal of communications consulting firm ASO Communications. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you, Jack.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.